The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
On Friday here, we had a Dharma practice day on compassion, meditation practice of compassion. And I'd like to follow that day with a talk on the practice of compassion. It's been, in the last while, I've been trying to do some teaching on the topic of compassion. And it's occurred to me that I don't know what compassion is. And I think that's a good thing. And and maybe it's different things at different times, different things for different people. Or perhaps it's something very wide that if you try to pin it down, say this is exactly what it is, it kind of misses the point. I did try looking it up in the dictionary I have at home to see what compassion is. But the dictionary says, the Webster Dictionary. It's a little bit old dictionary, but it's not ancient. And the definition was to feel sorrow in the pain and suffering of others. And so that didn't quite, that was kind of, I wanted to look at more dictionaries. I didn't want Webster to have the last word. And sorrow, it feels kind of painful. Sorrow or disturbing or distressing. But my involvement in Buddhism over these many years has been in part an exploration of compassion, and I feel like I've learned a fair amount about compassion from Buddhism, even though I don't know what it is yet, and exactly what it is. So we have in English, compassion kind of lends itself to kind of a technical definition or something very heavy and big and grand and idealistic. And there's a word that in English that is much more ordinary, which might be as instructive here today, and that's the word caring, or to care for, to care. And why it's instructive is that it has two meanings, at least. If you care for someone, it can be both a active verb where you go and bring them, someone who's sick, you bring them a meal and you're caring for them or you tend to the sick. But caring could also mean that it doesn't involve any action on your part but is a feeling you have for someone. You care for someone can mean that you have affectionate concern for them in some way. So in context, you understand if someone says, I cared for Joe or Susan. The context tells you that whether they actually tended to them or whether they just had, sat in their own privacy of their own living room on their couch and had all this caring feeling. So for me, one of the things I've learned from Buddhism is that Buddhism distinguishes between two different kinds of caring. Those two different kinds, in a sense. A kind that is more the affectionate concern, that doesn't necessarily mean there's any action involved, and that which involves some kind of action or involvement with people. And in the ancient time in Buddhism, the time of the Buddha, those two movements had two different words. And the word for more internal, private caring for someone was called karuna. And that's the word that became, then over time, over history in Buddhism, became the central focal point for Buddhist teachings on compassion. The word karuna gets used. In fact, many people in the modern West, when they hear the word karuna, that's the only Buddhist word they know that has to do with compassion. And they'll easily translate for compassion, and it's used in the service of all the different ways in which a person can feel compassion or caring. which lends itself, when you have one word that carries too many meanings, it lends itself to some confusion or some ambiguity, and you don't quite know how to find yourself, or don't know if people are talking about the same thing. So in the ancient time, the Buddha's time, karuna was more the internal, private feeling, affection, concern, caring that a person could have. The word for being more actively involved in doing something in the world that was compassionate action was the word anukampa. Kampa means to kind of be stirred, to be moved, and anu kind of with or towards, be stirred towards someone. And so when the ancient texts talk about the Buddha teaching out of compassion, they use the word anukampa, not karuna. And karuna in the ancient texts was almost only used for the kind of compassion you'd cultivate in meditation practice itself. And this, I think, is quite remarkable, that there are religious traditions, spiritual traditions, that discuss and give instructions about how you can cultivate and develop and strengthen your capacity for compassion, as if that's a good thing to do, it's a useful thing to do. Some people hear that, and they get, even the very idea of is distressing, because compassion is, in some people's mind, is not associated with something wonderful. It's associated with opening up to pain and feeling vulnerable by it, feeling victimized by it, feeling threatened by it in some way if you open too much. If you're compassionate, if you feel that you read the newspaper in the morning and you have your compassion door completely wide open, some people get quite discouraged or overwhelmed. And so the idea of being compassionate, some people is, you know, So these two ideas, you know, there's a private internal karuna, which is associated with internal life, but it's also associated with something you can cultivate and develop internally. You don't have to be just live with whatever the native degree of karuna that you happen to have. You can strengthen and develop that. For anukampa, for the compassionate action in the world, that is a whole other, you know, way of being than karuna that requires a lot of wisdom. Because as soon as you start acting in the world, you have to understand what's going on pretty well. There's a very famous term in American Buddhism, coined by a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, a teacher, idiot compassion. And so it's possible to, you know, to use his term, be an idiot in how you express and live your compassion. You need wisdom to go along with it. You don't need a lot of wisdom, but you need some to do the internal part of compassion. So Buddhism has this idea you can cultivate the internal affection, internal caring, internal love, concern for others and their suffering through this meditation practice on compassion. And this goes along with how in the ancient Indian world, let's say it this way. What's interesting about the word karuna is that people who study Indian languages and Indian religions have pointed out or have a theory that the word karuna is a cognate or linguistically connected to the word for doing ancient religious rituals. The action of a ritual action in the ancient world, it used to be called karma. And karuna and karma have the same root. And so there's something about karuna that is perhaps offered as a substitute for ritual action. And there's an old story from the time of the Buddha of some Brahmins who were used to doing Indian rituals, sacred rituals, in order to get reborn in good places, in the heavenly realms. And they come to the Buddha and said, you know, what can we do to get reborn in these beautiful heavenly realms? And perhaps they were expecting to be told, oh, these are the ritual actions you do, you make a fire, you make offerings, and, you know, do different things. And the Buddha, what he did was he would redefine or rework much of the ancient Indian approach to religious life from being externally focused to being internally focused. So rather than external rituals that you're supposed to do, he talked about the internal transformation. So when these Brahmins came to the Buddha to talk about how can we get reborn in these heavenly realms, he said, oh, let me teach you. I'll teach you how to do that. And as they probably listened really carefully, and then he's going to teach them. And then he proceeded to teach them the meditation practice on loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And so here it was kind of like, you could see almost like a Aikido move, a Judo move, where you kind of work with the opponent's force and you transform it into helping them change themselves internally here and now, as opposed to doing some actions about, the future. So, and the Buddha said, if you can dwell well, deeply, be really stabilized in a meditation practice on these four kinds of love, then it's as if you're living in heaven. So sometimes it's called the divine abodes in Buddhism, abiding like you're in heaven. So this is also kind of unusual, so that there's a meditation practice where the sole focus of your attention while you're doing the meditation is compassion. So if you kind of were tracking your mind a little bit during this meditation here today, chances are a fair percentage of you, were not one-pointed on one thing the whole time, but rather your mind was jumping around some and going here and there, and you'd bring it back and you'd let go and come back, and your mind was, a lot of different concerns. Or if you were one-pointed about something, it might have been about something nothing to do with what's going on here and now. Imagine sometimes in your life when you've been completely preoccupied by something, maybe some difficulty, and what it felt like to be preoccupied and the state of your mind, the quality of it. It's possible to feel and sense what it's like for the mind to be obsessed about something. So similar to that, it's possible to be completely, not obsessed, but completely involved. So the full activity of the mind is focusing on compassion, the theme, the idea, the feelings, the intentions of compassion. And it's not involved with anything else. And this focus on compassion, meditation and practice of compassion, feels really beautiful, feels really wonderful. It's one of the great pleasures of life, one of the great forms of happiness, is to have this deep, concentrated focus only on compassion. Now, is this useful to sit in meditation and cultivate compassion? And is this an example of these Buddhists who just kind of withdraw from the world and do their kind of private little thing in their mind, and it has no benefit in the world around? So that's a good question. So we'll keep that in mind as we go through here. So this karuna in the ancient tradition, Buddhist tradition, was mostly done in reference to a meditation practice, internal feeling you can have. So I'd like to do a kind of a thought exercise with you to maybe give you a sense of how this can be developed, where it can go. So perhaps you might have to fill in your own example, since I don't know what kind of background you've had. But can you imagine a time in your life when you were with someone who clearly was having some difficulty, suffering in some kind of simple, very simple way, but that suffering didn't cause you any distress at all, where you saw that that suffering they're having was completely normal part of life, it's what they have to go through, and mostly, you feel compassion, concern, care for them, but you maybe even almost feel a little bit amused or delighted, and just want to encourage them, want to reassure them, but you're not distressed by it. Nothing's required of you. So the example I'm thinking of is a little baby who's sleepy and needs to sleep, and the baby starts crying, and I've been in situations that I feel compassion, concern, it requires something of me. But, babies, the only way they have to communicate is by crying. And so, of course, they're going to communicate that way. And there's some distress, so you hold them. And holding them, they're crying. You're holding them, you're rocking them a little bit. And for me, knowing that the baby's safe, things are okay, this is a normal kind of being upset, the baby, that I feel kind of, I don't know if muse is the right word, but delighted or kind of loving and caring, and I'm not at all disturbed by it. This is the nature of how it is. And as I hold the baby, I feel kind of very warm, kindly disposed. I feel it's nice for me. And some people actually like to hold babies because it feels so nice and comforting to do it. I don't know if it's fair to compare a baby to a cat, but you know, the babies here are not going to complain, so it's okay. But it's, you know, like when you pet a purring cat, the cat's on your lap and you're petting a purring cat, who benefits? You know, the cat's certainly benefiting, but I think there's a way in which you benefit, right? Usually it feels kind of nice and comforting to do that. So the same thing with this certain kind of crying baby. I certainly have held my kid crying as a baby when I didn't feel this way because, you know, other things going on. But there's a kind of very simple kind of caring concern that causes no contraction, no horror, no anxiety, no upset for me. In fact, there's a kind of, I don't know if it's okay to say a little bit amused. Is that okay, or does that sound callous? No, they're not good. So good. Some of the mothers here say no. Some people don't like it. Some people do. So it's kind of delighted, or kind of like, you know, just makes you almost like you just want to smile. Like, come, hey, I'll hold you. You know, it's okay. Yes.
Interest.
So maybe interest. Yeah.
I was thinking accepting.
So accepting. So very accepting. Any other choices of words? Those of you who don't like smile, amused. Feel connected. And, you know, sometimes an older kid, you know, they're on the playground, they fall down, they get hurt. And you can see right away that they're not that hurt. You know, there's no blood, you know, just things are okay, they're just hurt. And you know, you certainly have your concern, you're caring for them, you have your compassion. You know everything's okay. But you know that what's needed from you is to care for them. So you say, come over here, and you hold them, and it's okay, and, you know, you can do one of those, sometimes with the right kind of little owies, they're called. Those of you who don't remember. You can do, you know, one of the most powerful forms of medicine that exists for a little kid, and that is you can kiss the owie. And then they run off and they're back in the playground. So it's an example, you know, you kind of, at certain kind of little owies, you kind of understand this is part of life, this is ordinary, they're suffering, they're hurt, your heart opens up, and actually maybe your heart opens up even more. You're busy talking to a friend in the playground and talking about your taxes, you know, and whatever. And then you see the kid fall and the kid comes running over to you and your heart just opens up and is there for the kid, but you're not concerned. You're relaxed and open because it's not needed. You know, not needed anything more than that, just simple. So I call this simple compassion. Simple compassion is compassion where our heart and our caring flows out from us towards someone who's suffering, someone who's somehow troubled or in difficulty. And we are not disturbed by that ourselves. We don't contract. We don't get anxious. We don't get distressed. We don't... So karuna, the word karuna, I liken to this simple compassion. Actually, my preferred translation is simple compassion in this way. Anukampa gets more complicated because anukampa involves action and involvement, and as soon as you have to do something with people, it gets quickly, you know, complicated, right, those people. Compassion would be a lot easier if it wasn't for the people and that you have to deal with. But karuna is simple compassion. So the meditation practice on compassion is to begin developing this, the meditation on karuna, develop this simple compassion. And the best way to begin is to begin doing it towards someone for whom it's really easy to have this simple uncontracted, non-distressful feeling of caring. So, you know, the kid or, you know, the child or someone you know, someone who's mildly in trouble, mildly disturbed, someone for whom you can just feel and care for, but it doesn't cause anything for you to. So you begin there. And then once you kind of get a sense of what that simple compassion is like towards someone who it's easy, then is when the meditation practice on compassion gets more interesting. Because then you try cultivating the same feeling towards someone who is suffering, but for whom it's a little bit more difficult for you to have that, to have it be simple. You do get a little concerned. You get a little tense or contracted. So it's not dramatic, just a little bit so. And then you begin exploring what happened that it got more complicated for you. How did you get contracted? How did you get distressed? How did you get anxious? What happened? And then you try to work through your reaction to see if even towards this person you can come and discover the simple compassion, the open heart, the relaxed, very relaxed open heart that can flow towards someone. Now, to help you with that exploration, here's an interesting observation. So if you can imagine what the simple compassion is, it's flowing towards someone, your concern, your intention, your thinking is towards some person, but your compassion is not at all complicated, just easy, relaxed. If you get distressed, anxious, then your attention is no longer on the person, but your attention has moved to your distress. That when you get distressed, your attention, your focus of thinking and concern is no longer on the person. You've lost a connection with the person. And now you're connected to your own concerns, worries, anxieties, and all that. And so that's an interesting movement, to feel or look, see that how the movement is away from the person you're connected to. You're present with someone, even if in your imagination, you're present for them, and now you're no longer present. So I'm on the playground, you know, I'm talking about to some other parent, my kid falls and scrapes his knee, he's going to be okay. I'm concerned, come over here to me. You know, I'll give you a kiss on the owie or whatever. And then my mind goes, I wonder if what are the other parents are thinking about me. I hope they think I'm parenting well. When I start thinking that way, I've lost a connection to my child, right? I'm focusing on something else. Or if I'm focusing on the child and I remember how when I was in third grade, I just didn't have a simple scrape. I had this monumental wound and there was no one who cared for me at all. I had to go limping back to class and like blood down the knee and you know, the teachers couldn't even care. In fact, they told me, why are you late to class, you know? And so I've never recovered. And so when I see my son hurt on the playground, it reminds me of this unresolved injury that I had. And so rather than focusing on my son, now I'm focusing on my old unresolved issues around playground injuries. So there's many, many ways in which the focus of attention can leave the person and come towards some concern of our own. The idea in the Karuna meditation practice is to explore the ways which we make it complicated that way, that the focus of attention goes away from the person, and see if we can come back to having the direct concern only for that person with a heart relaxed and open and all that. It helps one of the reasons why it's really useful to do this as a meditation practice is that when you do it as a meditation practice, nothing's required of you to do. You don't have to solve any problems. You don't have to actually require to bring a meal to your neighbor. You're not required to kiss the owie. You're not required to figure out what's needed in the situation. Because during that period of time you're meditating, you're sitting with your eyes closed. Nothing's required of you. Except the practice is to see if you can strengthen, develop this simple compassion. Just that. So some people, when they do this meditation practice, confuse solving the problem with having the caring feelings. And that's one way to lose touch with a person, lose touch with a simple compassion, because you're trying to solve the problem. And so the advantage of doing as a meditation practice is you can put that aside. So you can cultivate and develop and strengthen this capacity. As you do the meditation practice, you start doing it over time, if you do it for a long time, to increasingly more difficult people to have compassion for. And in fact, the tradition says at some point, you'd even do it towards your enemies. You take someone who's really difficult, and someone who you really feel strongly about against, and you see, can you discover some way to feel the simple compassion for that person as well? I recently read I thought it was a beautiful little thought exercise to help that. So you have someone, some person, maybe a political figure or someone who you really detest, and how can you feel compassion for that person? Or someone who's, maybe a criminal who's done something. But imagine that the person's mother lives next door to you. And you're close to the mother. Can you just then treat the person as like pure evil or pure bad or pure like the other? When you have a connection to the mother and you kind of know how the mother feels, and the range of feelings of how the mother is. At least for me, when I read this exercise through that way, I kind of, this person is more complicated, is more to this person than my particular thought or concern or upset about who this person is. And so then I was easier than think, maybe I can have a simple compassion for this person, even someone who I feel strong feelings against. So the practice is to do this and develop it. And it's quite a remarkable thing to open your heart, keep it relaxed over time. The advantage of doing it in meditation is that then when we're ready to be engaged in the world in compassionate action, we know something of what it's like to keep the heart relaxed in the context of helping someone or being involved. And then because we know, in a kind of embodied, in a personal, very deep way, the capacity to be relaxed and open and present, and we've worked through many of the issues we have about how we get contracted or tight or get preoccupied or lose focus, we've worked through some of those, resolved some of them, then when we have to act in the world, perhaps we can act closer toward, more in touch with that simple compassion. We can act in a way we're at ease as we act. No matter how big and serious the issue is, perhaps we can come into the situation in a relaxed way, in a motivated way, very motivated, but we don't have to get contracted or tense. And it's from this perspective that I understand that the Dalai Lama keeps saying that if you want to be happy, be compassionate. The Dalai Lama probably didn't read the Webster Dictionary definition. But it's from the idea that he emphasizes, if you really want to be happy, care for others. And I think that it's because he knows about this, the power of this simple compassion. And that simple compassion is a motivating force for action in the world. It's a beautiful force. It doesn't mean we're going to be passive. But it means that when we do act, we're acting from the most beautiful qualities of heart that we have, free of anxiety, free of worry, free of fear, free of contraction. All these things that very quickly kind of make the compassion more complicated. So the final thing I'll say about the simple compassion something maybe I'm a little bit too fond maybe of mentioning it before, is how in this modern study of psychology and physiology, they have pointed out that in certain caregiving situations, the human body produces oxytocin, this hormone that makes people feel really well, feel happy. And nursing mothers release oxytocin. It's probably why their patient to sit there And because it feels so good, it's like purring, you know, petting the cat. Maybe petting the cat releases oxytocin. And so there's a kind of, the reason I like to mention this is there's a physiological basis for feeling good when we have simple compassion. It isn't just simply, you know, some idealistic thing. And there's a physiological basis for feeling anxiety or stress, or feeling stress when we feel anxious. And so these meditation practices are ways of strengthening those physiological and psychological responses to the world that bring a sense of well-being and health and healing to us, as opposed to those who do the opposite. So I find it quite remarkable that the Buddhist tradition, other religions as well, have particular practices that are meant for cultivating compassion, developing this, karuna. So I hope that these ideas that I offer you today are something that is a little bit thought-provoking for you, something you'll consider as you leave and live out your week this week. And perhaps you will experiment a little bit and explore and reflect on what your experience is of simple compassion. Connected compassion, open, relaxed, connected, without any worry, distress. And are there ways in which you can develop that more in your life? So we have about 5 minutes. And if any of you have any comments, questions, protests about this? Yes, please.
I happen to have the microphone, so I feel that it's so much easier to have compassion for people that I'm not in relationship with. So, for instance, a lot easier,
yeah.
To have that simple compassion. I went to visit an elderly neighbor of mine in a convalescent home the other day, and when I was with her, I could be really with her and have that simple compassion. When I left her, I didn't, you know? I just cried. It really touched something deeply in me. So what do you have to say about that? I mean, the people that you're close to, that you care most about, how can you have that same kind of simple compassion that you're talking about?
Maybe the question, what happens if we ask the question a little bit differently? When is it easy to have simple compassion for the people you're close to, and when is it difficult? Because are there times when you have simple compassion for your daughters or your family? Or is it a completely foreign idea?
I guess when it's not, when I feel totally centered, grounded, and I feel like I can completely help them. And I guess in the case of this friend that I was seeing the other day, I felt like I really couldn't do anything to change. I mean, with my children, I feel like there's something maybe I could do actively that would change, that would help
them. Has there ever been a time with your children where they were, you know, having some difficulty, and it was really clear that it was not appropriate even for you to be involved and do anything?
Sometimes they need to just.
And then, in that situation where nothing is required from you, could there be a simple caring for them, even so, even though nothing's required of you?
Sure.
So, if you have some reference point like that in your own family, then perhaps you can use that reference point to begin, because you know it's not all or nothing. There's a kind of a range, a gradation of how we go from simple compassion to more complex or difficult compassion. And so you begin exploring that range and exploring where it's a little bit difficult for you. And then stop and look more carefully. Be mindful. What happens to you? What's going on for you in that situation? Because if you try to do this investigation in the big, big, difficult sufferings of life, there might be too much reactions, too much emotions, too much thoughts and feelings and history and stuff going on. But start where it's easy. So start to find situations in your family life where it's simple compassion is easy for you to have. And then begin stop and studying the places where you just a little bit shade away from that. And then slowly you work your way down the range to be more and more difficult. Is that making sense?
It makes sense, but it also feels like there are times when you see suffering that deeply moves you, and it's appropriate in a way that
you get distressed and upset and worried and anxious, and
that if you feel the deep sadness,
yeah, it could well be. To me, I don't want to say, you know, as I said in the beginning, I don't know what compassion is, and I don't want to say, you know, what the human emotions or feelings or connections to others should be or shouldn't be at all. But what I like, what I really value, is the exploration of it. And different people are going to feel compassion or experience compassion in different ways from each other. Some people will experience it more emotionally. Some people will experience whole compassion. Their whole life is experienced more through the vehicle of their thoughts and ideas. Nothing wrong with that. Some people is more through their body. Some more through their feeling. Some people are more visual thinkers, so they have imagination comes into play, really important. Some people are more verbal thinkers. Some people are more introverts, some people are more extroverts. There's so many different... So the inner ecology is going to be different from person. And I don't know how anybody's supposed to be supposed to feel, but I think it's really helpful to begin... whatever you're feeling, put a question mark behind it, after it. Meaning, let's look at this. Let's look again. Let's look more carefully. What's really going on here? As opposed to one other possibility is to become a victim of things. Say, oh, it's just too difficult, and this is terrible, and this is the way it is. In Buddhist practice, we're not going to be victims of anything. We're going to turn around and look at it, at the minimum. We're in charge. Okay. So maybe one more, and then we'll stop.
I've been having a great deal. I'm new to meditation. Oh, thank you. Sorry. I'm new to meditation. I've been having a great deal of difficulty this week. My father died, and he was a sadistic man. And my son didn't have the same relationship, so I can feel compassion for my son's pain. But for my brothers and sisters and my mother, who are also abusive, I'm trying to work. I don't want to be tied up in the anger and the negative feelings that I have. And I'm trying. I don't know how you go about feeling compassion for people who have done you harm. And I don't know if that's something you're just supposed to get to, or if it's something that is just always on the horizon.
It's a great question. It's a great, great concern, and it's such an important thing you bring up that I feel a little bit reluctant to give simple answers to you. But if I may say a few things, one is that you're not obligated to feel compassion, and so that can hopefully free you up a little bit. But if you want to feel compassion. The wanting to do is a beautiful thing. Even if you can't do it, it's quite beautiful even to want to do it.
I do want to do it because when you were talking about feeling compassion, I have wonderful memories of my son getting owies and that whole wonderful thing that happens when you're just caring about them and calming them and making them feel safe and secure. I guess at a sort of selfish level, I thought, well, you know, there's a reward for compassion.
Right.
I guess it's that oxytocin that you talked about. And the thing is, the pulling back from having compassion for these people who have done me harm makes me feel smaller.
Yeah. Yes. So you're not obligated to feel compassion, but it's beautiful that you want to do it. And you should celebrate that little bit, appreciate that you have the desire. So you're not burdened by the desire, because it's easy to be burdened by the desire. Oh, I want to be, but I can't, so I'm a bad person or something. Just appreciate that it's there, appreciate that it's hard. And then realizing that it's hard, then you have to kind of find your way, what's useful to do. Sometimes what's useful to do is to forget about the person for a while and just deal with your own wounds, your own struggles, your own fears, that there may be a legacy of that relationship. And maybe there's things you have to do to work on yourself to be able to feel safe. Because if only when you feel safe, it doesn't make sense really to feel compassion for someone. So there's your own work to be done. Or maybe you don't need to do any more work, but you have to somehow have to understand or be able to get a perspective, a way of seeing the person that helps you break through the old way of seeing them, seeing them a new way so you can feel compassion. And one of the most common advices for doing this, when someone has been done bad things to you or is a bad person in some way, is to see if you can tune into the fact that that person's also suffering.
That is something that I do. I can sometimes recognize that in order to need and want to cause as much pain as came from there, that there had to be a lot of pain behind that.
Yeah. So that can help. So once you realize that, though, then there's another step you can make, which sometimes is helpful, and that is to understand that that person is suffering, you're suffering because of that relationship would happen, and so it's a shared suffering. And sometimes people, when they realize it's a shared suffering, it breaks down the very strong separation that some people have between self and other. And when that self and other kind of begins to soften a little bit and realize we're all in it together, then sometimes it's easier to begin softening and relaxing.
Thank you.
Okay, so karuna, simple compassion. I'd like to end with, if I may, it's a little bit maybe bringing in a big thing, but there's a beautiful little poem of at least two lines of a poem from a Japanese Buddhist poet, poetess, I'm not sure. There's a particular form of Japanese Buddhism where the focus of the religion is to receive the compassion. Say it this way: that somehow they view that there's kind of this compassionate force in the universe, this cosmic grand compassion that we can benefit from. That's here to kind of watch over us, take care of us, or something. And in order to experience salvation from this cosmic force, you have to call out for it. And the poem goes something like, the voice that calls out for this cosmic or universal compassion, the voice that calls out for this universal compassion is the very voice of universal compassion calling out to me. So, perhaps your desire for love and your capacity to love are maybe the same thing, or closely connected. Look at them both carefully. One becomes the other. So, thank you.